So now, we'll begin with the World Watchers, and we'll switch gears off to the next part of the program. This is broadcast number 651, May 28th, 1984. It's Memorial Day, so I decided to put a rest on some subjects such as Edwin Meese and the Cartergate Papers and John DeLorean with Johnny Carson. Remember last August I was detailing the mob connections to Johnny Carson and his bank. We'll put that off for till next week or the week after, okay? And the biotech and the Helionetics, and I thought we would just talk about some people that have been murdered and some interesting deaths. I could do that for 50 consecutive weeks. I have the articles on the bodies piled up at home, but I thought maybe being as it's Memorial Day and you're all in the mood for that, we would talk about that subject. Before I get into that, I do want to bring up and remind you what we were doing a year ago this week, because that was a very, very important broadcast. They all are. I was talking about Golden Boy, the book about William Holden. I believe he was murdered. And a year ago this week, I was talking about the bank that closed, headed by Johnny Carson, and that was the narcotic connections that he was protesting about. This week he didn't know a thing about it, but that's not true. I remember Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, saying he didn't know about Watergate, so I guess Carson can say he doesn't know about John DeLorean. And a year ago this week, I was talking about John DeLorean and his Asian heroin connections and the Columbia cocaine connections, and also a new book that came out on the Kennedy assassinations called Contract on America, Mafia Murders by David Scheim, S-C-H-E-I-M. He leaves out the name of Roy Cohn and Mo Dalitz and the connections to Paul Laxalt in Las Vegas, Laxalt running the Republican GOP money funds and the mob connections, the hit teams to the real murder of John and Robert Kennedy. And Roy Cohn, of course, is on the board of Western Goals, piped into the Los Angeles Police Department. We talked about the life and times of Klaus Barbie. He's been over in France for a long time, hasn't gone to trial yet, which is kind of interesting. And then last year was the story that broke in the Los Angeles Times, detective in spying case linked to the Birch Leader. And this was the story of Larry McDonald, who would soon be killed in September. This was in May 30th on Kazoo. We were talking about that. And that was the connection of the spying case of the Los Angeles Police Department of files that were ordered to be destroyed in 1975, being fed to the military offices in Alexandria, Virginia, not only to the Birch Society, but to Reinhard Gehlen's BND, the German intelligence, to Vienna, around the world. And there's a major lawsuit going on now of 55 or more people and celebrities against Western Goals whose names were in there. These are law-abiding citizens whose names go into national computers. It may get more attention than the case got during the year because of the prominence of the people involved. Before we get on to the obituaries for Memorial Day, I want to mention the technique of Ronald Reagan that's so clever and the people working around him. I mentioned last week when the story of Walter Rauf and how he got his passport from the Vatican to go to South America broke into the news, and there was a demand of Catholic groups to explain why the Vatican gave this top Nazi his passport. 5 days later, Walter Rauf was declared dead. This is called the cause and effect, before and after. So, of course, the coffin was closed, and everybody concerned said the case is closed. I don't believe it's proof that he's dead. But when they wanted an explanation, he was conveniently tucked away and the case was closed. When the headlines came out this past week, May 24th, William Casey, the CIA director, got Carter papers and his name was on them. They've been on them for a whole year and confirmed that he, in fact, has been part of leaking all the material to Ronald Reagan to run his presidency and his campaign. The next day, Ronald Reagan went to dedicate the building at the CIA and praised Casey as being a wonderful, wonderful man, and he dedicated a new addition to the CIA building that has 1.1 million square feet they're adding on. Can you see that size? 1 million square feet? $190 million. They need a little more for the lack of intelligence they have. They have to have this space. They said the computers take a lot of space. When the expose of Henry Kissinger came out, when Seymour Hersh wrote his book about Henry Kissinger, The Price of Power, and spent 6 years on it, a Pulitzer Prize reporter. The very week that he did that, Ronald Reagan put Henry Kissinger in charge of Central America. His response to America was to promote Henry Kissinger. His response to the Casey story was to be seen and photographed with Casey smiling and happy and satisfied with Mr. Casey. When Edwin Meese was nominated as the Attorney General, and they had these scandals, and financial scandals, and connections of promotions and jobs and home payments due and promotions, high-paying jobs of people without the talent to do the jobs in return for taking care of his homes and his finances. When they got a special prosecutor going, the President of the United States says, we won't go into this until November the 6th, until after the election. So he quickly said, that's it. November the 6th, we'll look into Edwin Meese. And then he said, I will reappoint him. When I am elected, I will reappoint him, no matter what you think. When Ronald Reagan wanted $61 million for El Salvador, there was talk that four nuns had been killed and hadn't been solved. So they rounded up four street people, the most pathetic kinds of souls I ever saw, and one of them said he was threatened to be killed if he didn't confess to the murders. Well, why wouldn't you take that seriously when 40,000 were killed before him? And our Congress, the Democratic Congress, gave Ronald Reagan $61 million because they rounded up these four men, and the defense attorney didn't even know them. He had 24 hours on a case that's been going on for several years. The jury was locked up. He said, I don't care if they sleep all night or what they do. The jury can't leave. And the judge was so proud. And then Mr. Duarte can come to Washington. Now, that isn't Ronald Reagan's problem. That's Congress's problem. Instead of saying, wait, you can't have the $61 million until we speak to the defendants. They may not even be alive today, or they switch them. Those poor kids were dragged in off the street. So that no matter what happens, there's a response quickly, positively, and this kind of car out on the street. This kind of behavior has to be stopped. It's totally insane. Mother Jones has a good issue this week. I don't know if you can get on your newsstands or if you subscribe. There is a column, The Sleaze Thickens, by Deidre English. She describes the Reagan administration could be the biggest assemblage of crooks in the nation's history. Two more high-ranking officials may be added to the growing list of figures who've fallen under suspicion. There is another article, Corporate Practices, the FBI and the Bechtel Group. You saw some newspaper briefs on that. It's about the Bechtel Organization and payoffs of George Shultz, Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberger, our Secretary of Defense. There's an interview with Yoko Ono by John Weiner, W-I-E-N-E-R. He has a book coming out on the politics of John Lennon, and how the FBI were taunting him and how they have concealed papers and he has sued them. And then there's an article by Jonathan Quitney, who writes for the Wall Street Journal and does exposés on the Nugent Hand and the CIA banks. Oh, what a lovely war, and it's about Grenada. We got there just in time, Reagan announced, to the thrill of Americans. And this is about what happened, and the first casualty of war was truth. And, of course, I've done a lot of research on that. So this is one issue of Mother Jones with a lot of material on it. Now, as I say, in keeping with Memorial Day, we'll just talk about people who have been killed or caused murders, and in theme with the Memorial Day. The San Francisco Chronicle had a story from the New York Times. Bombing failed in Vietnam War, the CIA reported. The CIA concluded that the bombings in 1966 and 67 didn't do anything but help the North Vietnamese, and it brought in more aid, and that our dropping these bombs on native populations' heads didn't really help us at all. General Westmoreland has come to the conclusion. Now, it certainly, it says the bombing failed in Vietnam. The bombing didn't fail when it falls on all those heads. When you think of how many people died, the bombing worked. It just failed to a certain extent, but they shuffle paper around and give you a definition that maybe we should, now they'll go in, we need more missiles or atomic bombs because regular bombing doesn't work. So now they admit that the failure there, all those deaths and fatalities and people terrorized by bombs dropping Cambodia and Vietnam, thanks to Henry Kissinger and Fritz Kramer and Alexander Haig and the whole war effort, General Westmoreland, that gang, and the cast of characters who love these wars every 10 years have the nerve to come out and say that the bombings were a failure. What are all the Memorial Days and the coffins for, and the names on the memorial in Washington and all the bodies that are mutilated? What was that about? Now, talking about large body counts, we'll get into, I want to bring up the question of the new president of Germany. I don't know how many of you saw it. I've talked to several people this week, and it's in the New York Times, but not on the evening news. This is the New York Times. Richard von Weizsäcker, Weizsäcker, is the new president in Bonn, Germany. Weizsäcker was a person in Adolf Hitler's military. He's 64 years old. His father was working for von Ribbentrop. His father was a war criminal at Nuremberg, and he went to law school and defended his father. He's now the sixth president of the Federal Republic of Germany. He was a member of the SS. His father was in the SS. And interestingly enough, he traveled around with his father in Nazi Germany. His father, Ernest, not only worked for von Ribbentrop, but he was the, in 1943, he went from von Ribbentrop's department, chief state secretary in the Foreign Office, to ambassador to the Vatican for Nazi Germany. Now, 1943 was the year that the Nazis went underground, changed their names or changed their ideology. So Daddy went to the Vatican, and his son went with him, of course, and that's when Walter Rauf and Mr. Montini, the secretary of the Vatican, were getting ready to write passports for 30 or 40,000 Nazis and working with our intelligence and Alan Dulles over there in Switzerland, working close to the Vatican. So the new sixth president of Germany comes from that background. San Francisco Chronicle has a story that Mr. Weizsäcker was president of the German Protestant Congress from 1964 to 1970, served in the German army during World War II, went back to law school, worked for the Waldhausen banking firm in Essen, an executive of a pharmaceutical work, the Boehringer Pharmaceutical. I don't know if that's linked to IG Farben or not. And one story describes his father as a career diplomat, secretary in the German Foreign Office. In the book Who's Who in Nazi Germany, Daddy Ernest Führer von Weizsäcker is described the Foreign Office diplomat who served the Third Reich as state secretary and ambassador to the Holy See. And he helped overthrow Denmark. He was in with the spearheading of overthrowing various countries with the Fifth Column. It describes his father's work in Berlin in 1943, and he was arrested and put on trial as a war criminal by the Allies. And, of course, John J. McCloy released the war criminals out of the Nuremberg trials where they could get back to work. His daddy was released in 1950 and conveniently died in 1951. I guess they didn't want the smear of the father, who was a high-ranking SS. The SS are the choice people sworn to life to protect the 1,000-year Reich. He got out in 1950, but his son is now the sixth president of Germany. In the Brown Book, it describes, again, Mr. Weizsäcker, his father, and it said how he worked in the organization of the aggression against Denmark and how the fascists worked in the Denmark. The Secretary of State, Secretary von Weizsäcker, had high secret meetings and helped plan the overthrow of neutral Denmark. And then it goes on to say how von Ribbentrop, the boss of his father, was hung as one of the high criminals of the war, but he himself got off, Weizsäcker got off. Only a handful of the top ones were hung, and he got off. In the Brown Book, it describes the fascist Foreign Office and the imperialist Office of Conquest, and it describes Undersecretary Weizsäcker and his other Nazi friends and the Reich offices and the Wehrmacht. This is one of Hitler's top Nazis, whose son now is the president of Germany, whose father was sworn in the SS, the elite group, and so forth. Now, the president is going to Normandy, again, to the war stories. This is Memorial Day, right? He's going over there to Europe and to Normandy to see the beachhead. It's 40 years since the invasion of Normandy. The New York Times has an article I call the chutzpah of the year. The German government wanted to be invited to the celebrations, But Chancellor Helmut Kohl is ready to resign. He's through now, and the new Nazi president will take over. Mr. Weizsäcker wanted to come to the party, and the French said, no, he better not come. As a matter of fact, until Mitterrand was president, Gustave Dessalines wouldn't celebrate the defeat of Germany. He's so pro-German that it was not allowed to celebrate the end of the war. But there's going to be this anniversary celebration, and the Germans wanted to send a representative to the celebration of the invasion of Normandy. Now, in keeping with Memorial Day, I have a newsletter from the Bulge Bugle. I didn't know there was such an organization. I should have known. But Jim Cooley, who's writing a book about a person who was in the Battle of the Bulge and taken prisoner, has been a friend of mine. He's an author. The book will be coming out soon, and I'll let you know about it. He takes the Bulge Bugle, and he sent me a page of it from Volume 8, Number 1, March 1984. And there was a reunion of guys from the Bulge, and evidently this comes out. And of course, I'm going to send for it. And it tells about the Germans building up for the Battle of the Bulge. And see, this was the turning point of the war because the Nazis had planned from 1943 to 45 that if they were going to lose, they'd put all of the top officers of the SS and the Wehrmacht into a geographic section like a pocket. Then General Patton and the Americans would surround this area and round them up, and among them was Henry Kissinger, a young private in the army, and they'd put them all in a special place and then release them, let them write the history of the war, and incorporate them into the American intelligence and put them on salary to America. And that way they wouldn't be scattered or grabbed up by the Russians. So there's a description in this Bulge Bugle of part of their meetings and some questions about the Bulge they're still asking. Then there's a picture of the Secretary of the Army here at the party, Honorable John Marsh, Jr., Secretary of the Army, and he's shaking hands with somebody, but there's no article about him, and the man is Fritz Kramer of the 84th Infantry. Now, that's my old friend Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger's mentor, and in the bulletin on the Battle of the Bulge, it tells about one horrible night when Clyde Bowden of Arlington in Virginia of the 84th Division remembered playing poker three nights in a row before the battle and then watching his poker buddies killed. A few hours later, three of them were killed. Well, I'm going to call some of these men back east this week. I just got this bulletin. And ask Clyde Bowden if he remembers what Fritz Kramer from the 84th, because Henry Kissinger and Fritz Kramer were staying in a hayloft somewhere, and the others went out to die. Here's a picture. That's Fritz Kramer. He, in the Bulge Bugle, this is the first public picture that I know about. I'm sure there must be more, but I've been harping on this character for 2 years and handing out bulletins, and it doesn't describe what he did in the Bulge or whether he knows his people, but it has him with the 84th, which is where Hitler's Fritz Kramer was, in the identical spot. So at least there is a newsletter, and we'll get on to that. Now, updating the John Kennedy assassination in memory of Memorial Day. An article this week, Gerald Ford will attend the GOP convention in Dallas and Nixon won't. I believe Nixon won't because he remembers he was in Dallas when Kennedy was killed and we talked about it a few weeks ago. I don't think he would dare the karma of Dallas go back at this time with these particular people. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the name J. David Truby, T-R-U-B-Y. He wrote me a letter about a month ago asking me for tape cassette of Mitchell Werbel at Larry Flynt's home, and I recognize the name right away because Truby wrote the books on silencers that I've mentioned many times on the air, and I've asked the researchers into the John Kennedy assassination and on the air and written letters, how come nobody has ever addressed themselves to the question of silencers that killed John Kennedy when the House Select Committee was listening to for bullets, how many bullets can we hear? I have talked about this over and over on the air with you and shared my feelings about why the so-called experts don't admit that they're silencers when Mr. Truby was writing books with pictures of Mitchell Werbel and, you know, Gordon Nobel and all these people. And I never wrote to him. So he wrote me a letter, and I thought, this is a good chance to ask him. He's the expert on silencers. So I wrote to him and asked him about it. Could silencers have been used, like over the Daltex building or at the grassy knoll that killed John Kennedy, and they're listening for these firecracker shots that would come from the roof or the third floor of the depository that are the obvious sounds and silencers could be used. And he wrote back to me and he said, I'm glad you like my silencer book. I now have four of them out. Was a silencer used on the JFK hit? It's possible. I don't know. It surely would fit the needs of the mission. Then he says, funny thing, I was in Chicago to interview Sam Giancana. Remember, Giancana and John Rosselli have been named in conjunction with the Kennedy assassination, and Giancana was about to testify before the House Select Committee when he was killed June 20th, 1975. He said, funny thing, this is really funny, I was in Chicago to interview Sam Giancana, with his permission, of course, for an article on the Kennedy assassination, and I was supposed to see him. His appointment was for the day after Giancana had been murdered. He had a date to see him on June 21st to talk about the Kennedy murder, and Giancana was murdered on June the 20th. He said he was hit with a silenced .22 pistol. I have seen the weapon. It is very much the same used by our CIA folks. The mob uses it too. And then he said to me, we should do an interview together on this sometime. Maybe if he makes an interview with me, I'll be dead the day before. I don't really want to interview him, but maybe talk to him on the phone. Then he said, General Fritz Kramer, I heard the name when I was in active duty in 1960-61, but he didn't remember details about him. Then he said, I have an article soon in Gung Ho, which you'll have to look for, on the missing Bob Murrow. Remember, Bob Murrow wrote a story on the John Kennedy assassination. He said the book was called I Bought the Guns That Killed JFK, or he referred to that. He said, I did a couple of national articles on him, and he seemed legitimate. Now he's gone away, and he's missing. So that's the second person who's had a sort of a demise or a disappearance, one definitely killed and one's missing. And he wrote to me and wanted me to write back, J. David Truby. He's active with Soldier of Fortune and the books on silencers and weapons for our special elite army people. So he knows a lot about where the bodies are buried, and I was glad to hear from him. I want to meet him. Jesse Jackson is the first presidential candidate to mention a political assassination in America. It's been 20 years since Kennedy was killed. And I always said, if any candidate ever mentioned the fact that there was a conspiracy in this country, I'd vote for him right away. Jesse Jackson had interviews the last couple of weeks. These are the stories like in the Chronicle. Jackson links the government to Martin Luther King's death. He says, nobody would ever convince me it was a one-person operation. I believe the government had a role in Dr. King's assassination. The FBI said their role was to stop the black movement, to stop the black messiah. I don't know what there was, but the climate was set for discrediting King. And he said, I saw James Earl Ray. I met with him in prison. It's clear he was involved. It's clear he wasn't capable of pulling that off. I remain convinced that he couldn't have done it. And he says he believed there was a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. Can you believe that somebody running for presidential office in the United States can actually say that a conspiracy to murder somebody in this country existed when there are literally thousands of deaths? As John Stockwell said, the CIA has killed about 1 million people. But here's a candidate who says, I believe they did it, and there was a conspiracy, and there's no way that James Earl Ray did it alone. Well, right after he had that interview, he had 4 days later an airplane problem where he almost, he was flying from Florida to Dallas, and he was so scared that he got on the ground and kissed the ground in Dallas, Texas. Washington Post has a story. FAA experts checking Jesse Jackson's plane for structural damage. And it was a special plane. The Secret Service is investigating a four-engine turboprop Lockheed that was chartered from Galaxy Airline in Fort Lauderdale. It's the only one plane owned by the company. It's a company that has only one plane. Can you imagine what kind of a company that is? And it's used for charter flights from Florida to Las Vegas to Atlantic City. I mean, this is a one-company mafia plane that they're putting Jesse Jackson on when he's talking about killing Martin Luther King, and the mob had a good role in that. Luggage flew around. They blamed it supposedly on the weather. They were singing Taps, thought they were going to die. Hunting Carter III said it was the worst plane he had ever been on, and they checked it for structural damage to see what happened to the plane, in addition to whether they thought there was something dangerous about it. And this one of the four engines was shut down on a flight recently from Baton Rouge to Columbus, Ohio, and that's the plane they gave Jesse Jackson. And right after that, within a couple of days, Jesse Jackson's best friend, the most prominent black person practically in America outside of show people like Richard Pryor, Michael Jackson, a developer in Washington, D.C., a well-known man in Washington, D.C., close to the black political scene, as I say, a close friend of Jesse Jackson's, he was killed in a plane crash. Theodore Hagans II, H-A-G-A-N-S. Now, this was in the Washington Times, the Washington Post. I didn't see it on NBC or CBS. Do you see the nightly news about this particular gentleman? Extremely wealthy developer in Washington, D.C. He had caused a lot of trouble for the powers that be. In 1964, he had challenged the Corinthian Yacht Club because they barred him from membership because he was black. The club lost their lease on federally owned dock because of the lawsuit. In 1971, he became a leader and challenged the civil rights organizations and became the first black to serve on the board of directors of the Potomac Electric Power Company. I guess there's no more blacks there anymore now. He and his son were killed, and they said the exact cause of the plane crash is unknown. It is an apparent failure of one of the plane's engines. You know, we have apparent heart attacks. There's apparent failure of the engine. It's at a time when he's working hard to get Jesse Jackson elected. He has a beach house on Marco Island, an exclusive resort in Florida, evidently an extremely wealthy man, and he also owned a good hunk of the franchise of the multi-million-dollar parking concession at the Dulles International Airport. That's usually remaining job for the mafia. I understand that they have a big control of the airport, the franchises there, and the parking. But he had a big hunk of that, and he's gone, and his son is gone, the man who could follow him. A loss of the black community, of an organizer, of a political activist who was working in the system and making it, who has an apparent failure of one of the engines and is killed. And one of the problems, granted, planes don't always hold up, but there's a conspiracy of silence around these people that is eerie, too, because you're not getting very much about that. Now, People magazine had a rule for quite a few years that was described in the San Jose Mercury, don't put pictures of dead people or black on the cover. And now they've changed their attitude, and it's an article about People magazine called Cover Former Lives by Joan Kaufman. And it says you almost have to be dead to be on the cover. Dead is better than alive, and it tells about how many covers they sold when Jessica Savage died, Dennis Wilson, Karen Carpenter, Grace Kelly, John Lennon, goes into Natalie Wood, and it says, dead people are the right stuff. And this person wrote, when I started 2 years ago, it was unusual to have someone dead on the cover, and now there's a joke. There was a joke then that you couldn't be on the cover if you were dead or black. But after Kennedy was assassinated, they didn't have Kennedy. They had Lyndon Johnson. But they changed all that. Elvis Presley in 1977, when they had the cover, it made so much money, and John Lennon made so much money. And this article is about these dead people that are bringing in the bucks. The Lennon murder brought in over 3 million copies were sold. Can you imagine? And Newsweek, and it's really very popular when the celebrities die. Well, one of the things that is attractive to people, I think, is that their sense that something is wrong, these Jessica Savages or the car of Grace Kelly going over the hill or the way Elvis Presley dies with nobody attending, you know, dead on the floor in the bathroom, and John Lennon just ready to come out with a new album to emerge after being secluded so many years. There's an aura or a mystery. There's a similarity between, if they're shot, the grin on the alleged assassin or the car in the ditch, the unsolved cases, nobody looking them up. People are buying it and wondering. They know about John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers. And now it's going to be a thing where the hype is to cover the dead people and make a lot of money, but they're also the attraction, I think, in the minds of people, like, what in the heck is going on? If I read this, will I know more about it? So dead is in, And, of course, since 1972, I said, and I haven't done it yet, I wanted to write a book called Murderville, USA, because I knew Dead was in 12 years ago, and it's getting really big. And as long as they're going to do these things, they're going to make bucks at the same time. It's just a half after the hour. We'll take a one-minute break and then go on to part two of this broadcast.